I'm Artie Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. With two political conventions this week and next, the battle for the White House officially starts this month, and what a fight it's going to be. 4 years ago, the Republican Party enjoyed a trifecta, taking control of the three branches of government. While Trump promised to drain the swamp, the wealthy and well-connected have been the big winners, looking at the stock market and the growing income divide. Our guest, Yale political scientist Jacob Hacker, asks and answers in his new book, Let Them Eat Tweets, why the GOP, with its policies that favor the rich, has been able to win over so many working class voters who don't have investment portfolios and trust funds to leave their kids. He writes with his co-author Paul Pearson that the party has been able to tap into public outrage to get and hold on to power despite its support for unpopular positions, creating an alliance between plutocrats interests and populist political forces. And he joins us by Skype on Radio Times to tell us more. And Jacob Hacker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's such a pleasure to be here, Marty.
Well, let me start with the title of your book, which is obviously a riff on Marie Antoinette's Let Them Eat Cake during the French Revolution. By using tweets in your title, are you saying that, especially working class voters, they get tweets which feeds their outrage, but they don't get the policies that really benefit them?
Yeah, I mean, tweets are a metaphor here for the kinds of outrage stoking that predated Donald Trump, but which Donald Trump has perfected. And, you know, we start the book with the sentence, this is not a book about Donald Trump. And you have to kind of see Let Them Eat Tweets alongside that, because the tweets are a distraction in two senses. One, they're a distraction from the real issues that matter to most Americans, and a way of stoking this outrage around issues of race and culture that drives people to the polls, but which then results in a government, as you said, that is actually more responsive to those at the top. And at another level, the tweets are a distraction because Donald Trump is a source of division and constant distraction for the media and for Americans. And his divisiveness and his ability to kind of shift the focus to whatever outrage he wants to focus on is really kind of part and parcel of this new Republican Party that we describe as being a plutocratic populist party.
Which is such a strange thing, the plutocrats and the populists coming together in one party. But what do they have in common?
Well, they have in common two things. And let me just define terms. So by plutocracy, we mean government of, by, and for the rich. And in particular, we mean the organized forces of the rich, both business groups and individual billionaires, you know, the Charles Kochs and Chamber of Commerce and, Americans for Prosperity. Right. And by populism, we mean what, you know, we usually refer to as right-wing populism, you know, ethnic and nationalist kind of backlash politics. And you're right that uniquely in the United States, you've seen this bitter brew of plutocratic economic priorities and right-wing racial and cultural backlash. And I mean, this makes the Republican Party a pretty stark outlier in comparative perspective, because in most rich countries, you either have mainstream conservative parties, which the Republican Party once was, or you have right-wing parties, which tend to be, these populist parties tend to be pretty pro-welfare state. They tend to be pretty into providing direct benefits to white voters who back them, white working class voters who back them. But that's not true of the Republican Party.
And I wonder whether, when looking at, as you define them, populists and also plutocrats, whether there is a, I don't know, distrust or mistrust or suspicion of government. Is that something that kind of holds this group together?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our last book, Paul Pearson and my last book, American Amnesia, was really about the rise of this kind of animus toward government that united the sort of more racial and cultural appeals and the more economic sort of libertarian anti-government appeals. And this has really been part of the GOP playbook since at least the 1990s, when Newt Gingrich realized that to take control of government, he really had to take down government. And he he once said that, you know, he only had two enemies. One was Republicans and the other one was Democrats. So, you know, his idea was...
Which was why everyone loved him so much, right?
Yeah. Well, and there's a sort of a reacquaintance with Newt Gingrich, not least because Julian Zelizer wrote a good book on
In fact, he was on
Newt Gingrich's
Yeah, he
power.
Was on Radio Times talking about that book. Yeah, it's terrific.
But you're absolutely right. And this is one of the ways in which we think this common trope that, you know, that anybody who says that, you know, the downscale voters who vote for the Republicans are being duped, you know, anybody who says that those voters are not getting what they want are saying that they're being duped. And we're not saying they're being duped. We're saying they've been radicalized and that they have come to see their they've come to see government as foreign and they've come to see politics in very us versus them terms. And so that can explain why you have this hardcore base of Republican voters, most of them located outside major urban centers where their votes are amplified for reasons we can talk about because of the rural tilt of our system. You have these voters who are willing to come to the polls again and again and vote against government, vote against Democrats, vote against urban America, vote against gun regulators, and vote against their interest in terms of economics.
Well, and I do want to get to all that, but it should be said that there are plenty of wealthy millionaires, even billionaires, who support the Democratic Party. I think of Silicon Valley. Now you think of George Soros or Tom Steyer. How are they different? And do they want something different from the Democrats or from government compared to the Republicans you're talking about?
Yeah, so there certainly are plutocrats on both sides of the political spectrum. I think we tend to forget that the very richest Americans lean heavily towards the right. A recent study found that of the richest the 100 richest families on the Forbes wealth list, 2/3 of them gave exclusively or mainly to Republicans. So the other thing is that the most organized organs of the rich, namely business groups and big donor networks like the Koch network run by Charles Koch, those tend to be heavily on the conservative side too. But there are very prominent and often very visible liberal billionaires, from George Soros on the left to Bill Gates on the center left, and if you start to look at it, with some exceptions, most of them tend to be of a certain orientation. They tend to be more moderate or even liberal on social issues, and they tend to be somewhat more conservative than most Democratic voters on economic issues. In fact, there was a great survey done of tech entrepreneurs, speaking of Silicon Valley, by two political scientists at Stanford. And what they found was that tech entrepreneurs were more anti-government in terms of regulation and more anti-labor than even Republican voters, which was really striking. And so the other thing is, you know, they tend to support some of the policies that the conservative plutocrats do, particularly big tax cuts for corporations and those at the top. You know, Tim Cook of Apple is a very progressive guy, but when the tax cuts of 2017 were being formulated, he was definitely there saying that there needed to be special provisions for companies like Apple with lots of money banked overseas.
As you mentioned, this did not just start in the last couple of years. This trend, it actually, as you write about it, goes back to the 1980s with the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And let me play an ad. This is actually an ad that was for George Herbert Walker Bush. This was 1988. It's an ad titled Weekend Passes. And it features this mention of Willie Horton. I want to play it and give you a chance to talk about it.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
So Jacob Hacker, first of all, that's, you know, just horrifying to hear hear that particular ad what this man, this prisoner did who was on furlough. Nonetheless, you say that that ad really defines a kind of turning point. Explain.
Well, interestingly, George H.W. Bush, whose campaign ran that ad, was really the last moderate Republican in the White House. But in terms of campaigning, he ended up being pretty tough, as we see in 88. And this, the thing you can't see because you're only hearing the ad is that image of Willie Horton is of this very menacing looking black man. It was clearly playing the race card. In fact, political scientists have studied this one ad more than probably any campaign ad ever, with the possible exception of LBJ's Daisy ad. And they've studied it because it's effective at evoking race without ever using words about race. And that kind of racialization, we argue, is a big part of how the Republican Party managed to make the kind of backlash against the civil rights of the 1960s a kind of integral part of their campaign. But until campaigns and rhetoric, but until Donald Trump, for the most part, this was coded rhetoric, like in that ad. So two things to say there is that so Bush did not govern for the plutocrats. In fact, he raised taxes in 1990, and Newt Gingrich, whom I mentioned earlier, broke with him over that tax increase for the rich and made tax cuts for the rich, as well as big spending cuts, particularly healthcare spending cuts, the centerpiece of the Republican Party's agenda. But the other thing to say about George H.W. Bush is that his son, George W. Bush, really took the Gingrich formula of big tax cuts for the wealthy and brought it to the White House. So there's a really fascinating generational story where the old Republican Party personified by George H.W. Bush gets replaced with this new, much more conservative, much more plutocratic party of George W. Bush and then the Republicans in Congress.
So we're almost up in a break here, but just quickly, I mean, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush number one, did not win re-election. Do you think that's because he raised taxes and got the elite angry?
No, I think he mostly didn't win because of the recession. And that sort of drives home a story, which is that the elite can shape lobbying and policy, and they can invest in elections, and they invest a huge amount, but they're not the voters. And so the central problem for the Republican Party was figuring out how to serve the elite with policy, but actually attract, you know, an increasing share of white voters, which meant that they were having to attract an increasing number of white working class voters over the course of the 2000s and 2010s.
And we will pick up on that after this very short break. That's Jacob Hacker. He's a professor of political science at Yale University, co-author with Paul Pearson of a new book. It's titled Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in the Age of Inequality. You can join us. Send us an email. In fact, already see emails coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call us the old-fashioned way. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Time.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskow-Wayne, talking with Yale University's Jacob Hacker about his new book, Let Them Eat Tweets. It's how the GOP won over working class voters with policies that essentially favored the wealthy and well-connected by appealing to outrage. Let me read a couple of comments, and I do want to play another clip, and this is from Linus. He says, it seems to me the Republican Party, especially reflected by those at the top, has become an extreme right-wing fringe group, and the Democratic Party replaces it as the conservative party, completing a process began even before Bill Clinton. Will this process make room for a new party that's more progressive? And Jacob Hacker, it seems to me we're talking during the Democratic convention. That's really a big question before the Democratic Party and its leaders.
It is. And to come back to the what we were discussing earlier, the sort of billionaires and other affluent members of the Democratic Party, you know, a key difference between the Republicans and the Democrats is that the Democrats are really cross-pressured by those billionaires. So remember, those Silicon Valley execs aren't that into organized labor, and they're not that into regulation of tech companies. And so they definitely pull the party, at least they muddy the party's message, but yeah, they definitely have this effect of making the party less committed, or at least portions of the party less committed to more full-throated progressive ideals. That said, I think a combination of the circumstances, the degree to which Sanders came close and then was able to broker some concessions with the Unity Task Force, have meant that the current Democratic Party leadership is pretty progressive in historical relief. And I wouldn't say it's if you look at the comparative data, it's a party that's very mainstream among left parties. It's probably a little bit more centrist than left compared with those parties, whereas the Republican Party is kind of off the charts. It's far to the right of conservative parties in other countries, including parties like the Tories that have gone pretty far right over the last generation.
Looks like Cliff isn't buying it, though. He says the Democrats are totally complicit in this as well. They turned their back on unions and became the party of the professional managerial class, with neither party representing the working class. The Republicans became a preference because they are actually successful amplifying right-wing cultural grievances to the forefront and upsetting the elites and social progressives that they resent, for better or for worse. And I guess the question is, if the Republican Party's really at its core represents the elite, how, which is a very small minority in this country, how have they been able to win? As you say, they've appealed to a lot of grievances and outrage felt among working class. But at the same time, it does raise questions about why the Democrats have been kind of flat-footed in their response.
Yeah, so let's start with the Republicans. There's a reason we focus on the Republican Party in this book. We've written about the Democrats in our prior work, especially our 2010 book, Winner Take All Politics. And there we lay out the case that the Democrats have been deeply cross-pressured. The way we put it in that book is that, you know, we like to think of the parties as being black and white. You know, one wears black hats and one wears white hats, depending on your point of view. But in fact, the story is much more about black and gray. And
So I will
come back to the Democrats, but let me just explain why we focus on Republicans and what the story is there. So we point out that throughout history, or at least the history of modern democracy, which is about 150 years old, we have seen conservative parties facing this dilemma as inequality grows. They faced it at the dawn of the 20th century when the franchise was expanding, so their voters, they were having to appeal to less affluent voters. And they faced it, we argue, in the U.S. As inequality skyrocketed in the 1990s and 2000s. And the dilemma is basically, how do you stay true to your traditional economic elite allies while also attracting votes so that you can stay in power? And there are basically three answers, right? You can either moderate, you can become a more economically moderate party, you can rig the vote, which is a lot of, as we describe in the book, or, and you don't have to choose, but usually this last one goes with vote rigging, you can resort to outrage stoking. And that's, we see that across countries, we see it in history, and we see it in the Republican Party. And so by that, we mean that they start to realize that they're just not going to win if they're pursuing what the Koch network, the Chamber of Commerce, does without having allies who can gin up voters. And those allies are groups like the NRA and the Christian right, and right-wing media, which isn't a group, but comes to play a really fundamental role in this process of voter radicalization. So that's really the story. But I want to be clear, we're not arguing that, you know, anybody dreamed this up. There are a few people who are really central, like Lee Atwater, who is the Republican political operative who came up with that Willie Horton ad. But, you know, it was much more a trial and error process where they figured out what they needed to do to stay in power if they were going to pursue a really unpopular set of plutocratic priorities.
Let me play, you mentioned the NRA, and let me play an ad. It's called The Violence of Lies. And we're just going to play the first 30 seconds of it. It aired actually June 30th, 2017, although it sounds very current. And it's narrated by conservative television host Dana Loesch. Let's give it a listen.
They use their media to assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. They use their movie stars and singers and comedy shows and award shows to repeat their narrative over and over again. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance, all to make them march, make them protest, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, burn cars, shut down interstates and airports, bully and terrorize.
And Jacob, she goes on for there, from there.
Yeah.
I mean, you get a flavor of it.
I'm getting outraged.
Well, in many ways, I was watching that with producer Debbie Builder this morning. I mean, in many ways, it's a very effective ad if you want to tap into people's outrage.
That's right. And what we've learned in political science is that outrage, emotion, are, you know, those kinds of visceral responses are really central, or at least can become really central to politics. And you know, I don't actually think that is always a bad thing, right? We see that kind of passion on both sides of the political spectrum. But when it becomes essentially a kind of engineered outrage stoking of the sort that we've seen, where each election, you know, people are made to be madder and madder against government, against the supposed enemies of the Republican Party, and against the kind of corruption that, ironically, the Republican Party is often exacerbating when it's actually in power, then it becomes deeply destructive. And it's deeply destructive. I think the thing that we really want to emphasize is that you have to understand that when Trump came into power in 2017 after having run a relatively economically populist campaign for a Republican, the two main priorities that got pursued in that first year were the most unpopular bill of modern times, namely the health care repeal and replace plan that barely was defeated, and the second most unpopular bill of modern times, according to the data, that is the 2017 tax cuts, which provided, you know, $2 trillion in debt financed benefits, 80% of the permanent benefits of which went to the top 1%. So we're talking about priorities that are very unpopular and very skewed toward the top, and thus a need to kind of gin up outrage and threat in elections to kind of activate people's kind of tribal identity so that they're not as paying as much attention to the ways in which their economic problems are exacerbated by the policies the party they support is pressing.
But are you saying that outrage really just Trump's paycheck? I mean, you know. I mean, we're talking obviously during the pandemic, which has essentially brought down, you know, whole portions of the U.S. economy. So we're in really difficult and uncharted waters. But, you know, don't people know what's in their paycheck to know whether they've been winners or, frankly, losers?
Yes, they do. And again, that's one of the reasons why, you know, in 2018, in the midterms, the top campaign advisors and top donors were saying, look, you can't run on the tax cuts. It just doesn't work. People don't believe it was helpful to them. You need to run on an immigrant invasion or something else. But I think the economics is really fundamental. And one of the things that Paul Pierce and I argue in this book is that it's a real mistake the way that people have framed this. Is this about, you know, racial backlash, or is it about economic insecurity? And, mm-hmm. you know, that is, and then they tend to want to focus right away at, you know, what did voters think? And I think we really have to understand that economic inequality and insecurity have fundamentally reshaped our politics because we've had so much greater a rise in inequality and insecurity than any other rich democracies. But it's not necessarily reshaped our politics solely through people's views. It's reshaped it because the Republican Party has had to respond to that and has adopted a strategy that stokes this outrage. But I really think that, as we say in the book, that, you know, it's really hard to untangle racism, distrust of government, and economic insecurity because the Republican efforts to tangle them together have been so successful. So we think that the insecurity that white working class voters are facing is really important, but it doesn't necessarily channel into, say, more progressive economic positions in a context in which the Republicans are stoking backlash at every turn.
Let me reintroduce you. Let me first say, I got this from your book, that the richest 0.1%, I believe that's correct, 0.1% has as much wealth as the bottom 90% combined in this country. Just to underscore what you just said. said. Really talking striking. With, was that correct? 0.1%?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Right, yeah, it's 0.1%. And there's no other country where you see that kind of concentration of wealth.
That's
Jacob. No other rich country.
I hear you. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Jacob, well, I don't know if we're rich anymore, but we'll, that's probably a topic for a different conversation. Jacob Hacker is our guest. He's a professor of political science at Yale University, talking about a book he co-authored with Paul Pearson called Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in the Age of Inequality. You can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me just play one more clip. And you talk about the Republicans appealing to evangelicals. And here's Pastor Robert Jeffress, and he's speaking with Lou Dobbs on Fox Business News. This was actually last summer, August 30th, 2019, calling the Democratic Party a godless party. Let's give it a listen.
They seem to be a party of hate before any other equality.
And they are a godless party, Lou, and becoming more so. You remember back in 2012 when they had an argument on national television at their convention about removing God from their platform? Then in 2016 at their convention, they have a pastor up there praying and he gets heckled. And now, even this weekend, the Democrat Party passes a resolution saying we enthusiastically support the values of the religiously unaffiliated in America. Religiously unaffiliated is code for godless. They are truly becoming a godless party by their outreach and certainly by their beliefs.
What do you make of that, Jacob Hacker?
Well, I think it's really telling, right? And these clips have been great. As I said, the sort of organized outrage that supports the Republican Party is really ginned up by the National Rifle Association and the Christian right and right-wing media. And the Christian right is just a fascinating story because I think it really drives home the extent to which people come to see threats that may not exist, right? You know, the war on Christmas, the fact that this godless or worse Muslim party, right, that's trying to oppress them. You know, in 2017, white evangelical Protestants were surveyed and they were asked whether there was more discrimination against Muslims or against Christians. And 57% said there was more discrimination against Christians in the United States than Muslims. And so that kind of, there is certainly an element of truth to the worry about changing values or the decline of evangelical Christianity, because of course the church has the various Christian conservative branches have been losing membership, but then it's turned into this view that we're engaged in a war, us versus them, and it helps a lot that the voters who are most moved by these appeals are first geographically isolated, right? They're often in non-urban places around other people who share their views. Just as, to be clear, many urban people are around people who share their views, but also that they don't trust mainstream media. So in a poll in 2016, only 14% of Republicans said they trusted mainstream media. In fact, the trust gap in the U.S. is larger than in any country besides Israel, which isn't really the best comparison, because that's a country that's riven right now by both religious and political divides.
Here's an email from James. I'll just read a portion of it. He says, speaking for myself, the Republican Party didn't win me. It's more accurate to say that the Democratic Party lost me as a working class voter. I don't kid myself in believing that either party cares about me economically. I stopped believing that a long time ago. I'm also well aware that the GOP leadership couldn't care less about my Christian principles. So why do I still vote Republican? Mostly because the Democratic Party no longer has room for people like me, middle class, college educated, socially conservative persons of faith.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there are certainly lots of voters who feel that way, and they may reconsider in this election. I think that if you looked at the 2016 election, it's really striking the extent to which a significant number of those Republicans who voted for Donald Trump said he wasn't qualified to be president. Right? There was a lot of what we in political science called negative partisanship. You know, I cannot vote for the other side, and it may well be that that this in this case, we're talking about a really careful, considered judgment, because after all, the Supreme Court appointments that have come from the Republicans and Donald Trump, and with the support of Federalist Society and Christian conservatives who spend literally millions of dollars to make sure that people like Kavanaugh get onto the bench, that's worth a lot to many conservative Christians. But I actually think that for a significant number, a significant share of those who are voting for the Republican Party, it's much less about issues and much more about identity. And it's much more about kind of white, non-urban, gun-owning identity that really says that there's a threat that's out there that I don't think exists, or at least doesn't exist to the extent that these voters believe it does, that requires that they hold together as a group and vote against the other side.
Again, we're almost up in a break here, but are you saying that voting is sort of less about facts and more about beliefs, less about sort of intellect, more about tribalism?
Yes, we know that.
In a nutshell, right.
In a nutshell. But to be clear, I think our main point is that people don't just come to these views completely on their own, right? That elites matter a lot. And the way in which the Republican Party has worked to reshape these identities is really central to the story of how they've managed to pursue plutocracy, but still get the votes of many who aren't benefiting from their policies.
Here's a quick email from Philip. He says, regarding folks voting against their own interests, give people a group to hate and they won't notice their pocket is being picked, or worse, they will gladly empty their pockets for the GOP. We're talking with Jacob Hacker today on Radio Times. He's a professor of political science at Yale University. We've been talking about this book that he co-authored with Paul Pearson, and it's titled Let Them Eat Tweets: How the Right Rules in the Age of Inequality. You can join us. Send us an email, as Philip did, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Why in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Jacob Hacker about how the GOP, the Republican Party, both stoked, channeled outrage against issues involving things like race and immigration, gun ownership, Christianity, to get Americans to vote against their own interests and enable the Trump administration to continue an agenda that benefits both corporations and big donors. And again, you can join us, Radiotimes at WHYY.org. Jacob, as you said, and as you write in this book, it's not about Donald Trump, but nonetheless, here we are. It's 2020. The official race for the White House is beginning as a result of the two conventions this month. But you do say that Donald Trump really is the culmination of these efforts by the GOP. As much as 4 years ago they wanted to distance themselves from this candidate, nonetheless, here they are, sort of joined at the hip.
Yeah, and you know, that's a really important part of the story, right? As we say in the book, Trump didn't invent the machine, but he turned the dial to 11 on the machine. And the plutocrats were, you know, the plutocratic establishment side of the party was very skeptical of Trump during the campaign and even after he had won. But they very quickly realized that they could get a huge amount of what they wanted under Trump. And I think there are sort of three aspects of that are just worth mentioning. One I've already mentioned is the sort of big policy wins, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't get the health care bill, which they desperately wanted, but they did get the tax cuts. They got massive deregulation, which we could go into the details of, but Trump has slashed environmental, consumer, labor, and other regulations and staffed up his administration with often with, you know, either extremely conservative Republicans like like Mick Mulvaney and or former lobbyists for affected industries like Andrew Wheeler at EPA. And then the third thing is that they discovered that they also, at least initially, I think, felt as if the Trump presidency also involved a kind of mobilization of voters that they were having a hard time reaching, right? And I think Trump really showed that there was still a significant number of white voters that you could turn out on Election Day. And the central problem for the party has been that it's on the wrong side of these two great trends of our era, growing diversity and skyrocketing inequality. But if you know, and in 2013, you know, people were saying, you know, that the party really needed to reach out to Hispanics. And Trump showed that at least in one election, you know, if you're willing to win by the skin of your teeth, you didn't need to make that kind of multiracial outreach. And but now I think that a lot of that is becoming much more vulnerable than it seemed back in 2016.
It also seems the president has really put race front and center. I mean, he was one of the early on birthers about then candidate and, of course, then President Obama. He said recently, and this was shortly after Kamala Harris was chosen as Joe Biden's vice president, he said or tweeted, "The suburban housewife will be voting for me. They want safety and are thrilled that I ended the long running program where low income housing would invade their neighborhood. Biden would reinstall it in a bigger form with Cory Booker in charge," which, of course, makes no sense because he's a senator from New Jersey. Yeah. But nonetheless, you know, this idea of low-income housing invading a neighborhood. We won't even do the suburban housewives things because if you've been to the suburbs, you know, most of those housewives are working somewhere. But nonetheless, that is, I think, the most sort of recent racially tinged tweet coming from the president.
Yeah, I mean, Trump traded in the dog whistle, the sort of coded racial appeal for the bullhorn, you know, the explicit saying of the quiet part out loud. And there's a reason why Republicans had not resorted as much to these explicit racial appeals, had not sounded so much like George Wallace. And that's because they wanted to attract a broader cross-section of voters. They wanted people who are concerned about racial change, who were worried about the transformation of their communities, but which also they wanted to attract voters who were more tolerant of those changes. And that's sort of what Trump has done essentially is doubled down on the plutocratic populist formula that became increasingly central to the party. In a lot of ways, we argue in the book that the kind of outrage stoking and the groups that the party came to rely on and for outrage stoking, you know, had a life of its own, right? That once you start down that road, once you open Pandora's box, as we put it, it's really hard to close it. And you have to keep ginning up that outrage election after election. There's a wonderful or sort of frightening quote from John Boehner's chief of staff. You know, Boehner, of course, resigned after just having the most difficult time actually governing. And his chief of staff said, "We fed the beast that ate us." And Donald Trump is fully aligned with the beast, right? He stuffed the beast. And so that's what the party signed up for in a lot of ways by aligning itself with him in significant part, if you look at people like Paul Ryan, because of the conservative economic policy wins that they got. After all, just one quote on that. Mitch McConnell said famously, to me at least, in 2017, he said, was the best year for conservatives in 30 years, the best year on all fronts. And, you know, Charles Koch said, "We've made more progress in the last 5 years than I had in the previous 50. So they felt like they were getting something, but they got, I think, a lot more than they bargained for.
Here's an interesting question from Larry, who says, "How has political correctness impacted the election and parties?" Interesting, because I would say we have a president who is not politically correct at all by any means. But do you see that? And do you see that as a kind of tepid response to some of these more outrageous comments?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, one thing I will say, and it may not be a direct answer, that the accusations that, you know, everyone who votes for Donald Trump is a racist, right? The kind of rhetoric that you get around that has really helped Republicans, right, solidify the support of those who are most loyal to the president. Because this is a constant trope. We saw it in that clip you played earlier, or we heard it in that clip you played earlier, and we see it daily on Fox News, right? It's the idea that you are being accused of being of being deplorable, to use the famous quote from Hillary Clinton. And so that kind of that sense of grievance and resentment that is generated by what many voters see as a false accusation of racism is a powerful force for mobilizing. And I do think that for a very large share of white voters who are fearful of demographic change, it's a much less conscious response than we might think. There's a great psychological study by my Yale colleague Jen Richeson where she shows that just showing people, telling people that, you know, whites will be a minority of the country and in the future, moves them to the right on a whole host of issues, not just immigration, but also taxes and even drilling for oil, as if that has any real relationship to demographic change. So I think it's partly explicit, but a lot of it is implicit in our responses. And that's why I think this moment of racial reckoning that we're facing that has forced us to draw out in our own minds what counts as racism, I think has been very helpful. And we've seen actually fairly strong response outside of Trump's hardcore base in favor of a more progressive position on race. So that's the sort of hidden story of the Trump presidency, is that outside of his hardcore supporters, we've actually seen Americans move in a more tolerant direction. Whether that will hold, you know, if and when Donald Trump is not in the White House is a good question. But I think it's an important development that we should note.
Well, let me ask you about the post office. And as you mentioned, you think the Republican Party has been really skilled in selling its supporters essentially unpopular policies. Now we have attacks coming from certainly the White House on the post office, which, according to a lot of polls that I've seen, is one of the most popular institutions or organizations or government functions that we have. Do you see that as a risky thing for the president to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a calculated risk because it's pretty clear. Again, Trump has said the quiet part out loud. He's said what he's voiced the kind of logic that Republicans have used in their heads for the kind of vote restrictions they pursued, right? That the extreme partisan gerrymandering, the voter suppression efforts from, you know, encouraging long lines at the polls to requiring voter IDs, you know, that's all been seeking to reinforce white majorities, white rural majorities in particular, and Trump has essentially said that, and so he clearly thinks that, or at least if he's thinking about it, the fallout from saying that, a very unpopular position, is not as great as the potential downside of actually having everyone be able to vote in the fall election. But coming back to our discussion of anti-government sentiment, right? Yeah. Our government does not work that well. It has not handled this pandemic well, and that's not just because of the Republican leadership, but also because of the decline in government capacity that's occurred over the last generation. And you know, the fact is that this kind of long-term decline in our government's ability to tackle problems has not. Affected the parties equally. It's much worse for Democrats that they can't govern effectively because they do want to do things beyond just slashing taxes on rich people or deregulating than it is for Republicans. And so I think the post office is emblematic. The IRS is another story. We're hardly dealing with the kinds of massive tax fraud that's occurring, particularly among the very, very, very rich.
Let me read an email from Thomas and also just make sure our listeners know that you actually have some ideas for reform, not just a diagnosis, but there are things that can be done from your perspective. Just a quick email from Thomas. He says, Jacob mentioned a few times ways the party can win with unpopular positions, but there's another that went unmentioned, persuasion. There are economic and moral theories about why taxation, regulations, and redistribution is inefficient or unfair. There seems to be at least some attempt to make those points in right-leaning media in addition to all the outrage stoking. Just to add to that, you talk about making it easier to vote. That would be one form. Reduce the influence of money in politics. Get rid of the filibuster. Perhaps get rid of the Electoral College. Gerrymandering reform. Dealing with extreme inequality. Each of those is a giant lift. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, if that isn't enough, right? I think we should recognize that reducing inequality is got to be central to any effective response to what's happened to our politics. And that's sort of the deep structural reality that drives a lot of the polarization and the extreme outrage stoking that we write about in the book. And, you know, it's worth noting that we were not nearly as unequal as we are today a generation ago, right? We've seen the share of income going to the top 1% essentially double, and the share of income going to the bottom half of Americans essentially fall by half over the last generation. So we've changed. It's also true that we are much, much more unequal than other rich democracies, which makes you realize that policies and politics do matter, right? These countries are all subject to many of the same global and technological shifts that we are. So right now, I think the key priority for reducing inequality has to be restoring some progressivity to the tax code at the very top, you know, making sure that those at the very, very top are paying their fair share and that we're using that money in effective ways to that are visible to ordinary Americans. But I think over the long term, we're going to have to think about how do you, make our economy work better for workers. And that's going to include expanding labor unions. It's going to include changing the ways in which corporations are governed. It's going to include a whole set of policies that invest more in upward mobility for those who aren't at the top and so on. So to me, I would just want to put that there as if it wasn't daunting enough to go for political reform. We really do need to think about economic reform, because it really is the underlying economic shifts that we're talking about that have driven a fair amount of this this negative development.
Well, in fact, you and your co-author write that income inequality is a direct threat to democracy.
It is, and you know, that's been true since the dawn of democracy. You know, we talk about what we call the triple threat. That is, that when you have really extreme inequality like we do in the United States, those at the top not only have a lot more resources, they have more power. So that's one threat. They also come to see their interest is very distinct from the rest of Americans, right? They want the big tax cuts for the top, even though most Americans don't. So that's the second threat. And the third threat is that they become less invested in democracy. And we've seen that, right? The kinds of steps that the Republicans are taking, they are taking with the support of the organs of organized money. And moreover, we have lots of evidence, right, of economic elites and their allies saying the quiet part out loud about democracy. So, you know, Stephen Moore, we quote in the book, you know, the Trump's economic advisor who was for a short time his pick for the Fed. Stephen Moore said, you know, I'm not even a big believer in democracy. He said, I think of democracy as two wolves and a sheep deciding what to have for dinner, which, you know, he thinks the wolves are ordinary voters and the sheep is rich people who might have their hard-earned gains taxed away. So that's a real, I think, part of this story. So we have seen democracy dramatically erode, and it's under severe threat. I mean, if there's one kind of underlying argument in our book, it's that this kind of party that the Republican Party has become can really seek to undermine democracy to stay in power, and already has.
We have to leave it there. Jacob Hacker, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. He's a professor of political science at Yale University, co-author of this new book, Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in an Age of Extreme Inequality. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.